Greg Mortensen was an inspiration and hero to many Americans for his book, Three Cups of Tea, and his work building schools for children in rural Afghanistan and Pakistan. Unfortunately, his personal failings have cast doubt on the future of his charity, the Central Asia Institute, and have possibly damaged public trust about charities in general. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann Fisher, and this hour on All Sides, we're talking about oversight of charities and how to protect donors and improve transparency and ethics in the nonprofit sector. Later in the show, we'll be joined by the president and CEO of Charity Navigator, America's largest charity evaluator. Now we're joined by Stephanie Moulton, an assistant professor at The Ohio State University John Glenn School of Public Affairs. Professor Moulton has served on the Charitable Advisory Council to the Ohio Attorney General. Good morning, Stephanie. Thanks for coming to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
And also, we're joined by Lori Styron. She's the lead analyst at CharityWatch.org at the American Institute of Philanthropy. And before joining CharityWatch.org, Lori worked in nonprofits for more than a decade. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning.
And if you've read Three Cups of Tea or heard about Greg Mortensen and you were inspired or have thoughts or experiences about charities or charity oversight in general, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org or find the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Now, let's lay out the story of Greg Mortensen. He was a financially struggling mountain climber, a young guy not too far out of college. And in our introduction, I talked about the 60 Minutes investigation into Mortensen's book. Here's CBS's Scott Pelley talking with John Krakauer, an author and journalist who wrote a piece called Three Cups of Deceit, debunking many of Mortensen's claims. Here's Krakauer and Scott Pelley talking about Mortensen claiming he got lost and then stumbled into Corfe, a small village in northern Pakistan, after a failed exhibition up K2.
Did he stumble into this village in a weakened state?
Absolutely not.
So nobody helped him out and nursed him back to health?
Absolutely not. I have spoken to one of his companions, a close friend, who hiked out from K2 with him. This companion said, Greg never heard of Corfe till a year later.
That's certainly a journalistic no-no, but some would say that it's not that big of a deal. He crafted a story about how he got his start. Unethical, surely, but maybe not a total indictment of his work. Mortensen appears to take it a step further later in the book when he talks about being kidnapped by the Taliban. He published a picture in his book of his alleged capturers, and CBS caught up with one of the men in the picture. His name is Mansoor Khan Massoud, and he's the research director at a respected think tank in Islamabad. Here he is talking to Scott Pelley.
The story, as Mr. Mortensen tells it, is that he was held for 8 days and won you over by asking for a Quran and promising to build schools in the area. Is that true?
This is totally false, and he is lying. He was not kidnapped.
Who are these people that are also in the picture?
Some are my cousin, some are our friends from our village.
Well, why do you think Mr. Mortensen would write this?
To sell his book.
Again, it appears Mortensen is spinning yarns here, but nothing illegal, maybe. I don't know. Lori Styron from the American Institute of Philanthropy, your group did its own investigation into Mortensen. Help us take it from here. What other allegations have been made against him and his charity?
Sure. Well, we started actually investigating Central Asia Institute in early to mid-2009. What was really striking to us, we had received a lot of requests from donors for a rating of this organization. And when I started looking into it, what was really striking is that the charity's website was basically filled with advertisements for the book, extensive lists of Greg Mortensen's speaking schedules. The charity did have tax forms posted. We weren't able to locate audited financial statements for the group. About 40 of the 50 states require charities to register in their states as a condition of being able to solicit there, and about 20 of those states require audits. We were unable to locate any. We contacted the charity. I actually personally contacted the charity in late 2009 and spoke with their operations director, and she seemed a little frazzled and wanting to get me off the phone as quickly as possible. She told me that they don't have audits. They're working with an attorney to get it sorted out. We had subsequent correspondence with the organization, and they really weren't willing to answer any of our questions. I guess the key concern with the finances is that the group was incurring a lot of expenses in travel and advertising. and other things that most donors would not consider as being directly related to supporting schools in Afghanistan. So they were incurring millions of dollars of costs for domestic travel to promote the books and to fund the travel expenses for these speaking schedules, or what we think of as a book tour. And then they weren't reporting getting any of the revenues that were generated at these events.
And this is not a normal situation for a charity.
It's definitely not a normal situation from a charity. I mean, can you imagine most charities agreeing to absorb all of the business costs and risks associated with promoting an author's book and then not getting any guarantee that they would receive any revenue as a result?
Sure. You say that there were no audited tax forms. How much money are we talking about here?
Millions. I mean, over the life of the charity, about 14 years, you know, upwards of $50 million.
And so any other claims against Greg Mortensen or the Three Cups of Tea books, besides him saying he was captured by the Taliban, which according to the CBS piece, he was not, and also saying that he stumbled into this town of Corfe when it doesn't appear that he did. Are there any other indictments of this, or not legal indictments, but are
sure.
there any other claims against him?
Sure. Well, I mean, I have to just step back and say that really, if an author had, you know, sort of skewed certain things in a book and then used all of the money that was raised to actually, you know, help promote schools and build schools, I don't know that we would have been so concerned. It's sort of like, well, okay, a lot of good came out of it. It's unfortunate that this person was not being as honest or forthcoming as they could in their book, but I don't know that really would have, you know, really would have been more of a, you know, than maybe a blip on our radar. What's one interesting thing about the books, though, is that it turns out the charity's board actually admitted that they had used the charity's money to actually purchase thousands of copies of Greg Mortensen's books. So one question that has not yet been answered but that I'm curious about is, you know, would his books even have ended up on the New York Times bestseller list had the charitable dollars not been used to purchase them? Another big concern is that in the books and on websites that were linked to from the charity's website, they were telling donors that the charity was going to receive, you know, a certain percentage of the revenues from the book sales. And then later the board of directors admitted, no, actually the charity does not share in any of the royalties. Their defense to that was that Greg Mortensen, they claim, has donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to the charity. This is not a defense that we really buy. You know, first off, we looked through the past tax forms and through the one available audit that they do have, and there's no evidence that he donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to the charity. Secondly, if a charity is spending their own money to cover expenses for some revenue-generating activity, then they should be able to get those revenues directly. These revenues don't need to go to some third person and then later be contributed back to the charity. So it's really kind of a weak defense on their part.
Listeners, if you've read Three Cups of Tea or have heard of Greg Mortensen and were inspired by his story, or you just have thoughts about charities or charity oversight, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. And you can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. Again, Lori Stowering, you say this is not a normal occurrence for a charity, but how out of the normal is it? Have you seen anything like this?
Well, you don't see things like this because it would expose the individuals that are benefiting from these types of arrangements to excess benefit transaction rules under the IRS code. There was an attorney that was in contact with the charity that actually warned that Greg Mortensen could actually end up owing the charity millions of dollars, upwards of, I think, $20 million, if he's not able to pay back all of these excess benefits that he received from being someone in control of a charity who made arrangements under which he greatly benefited. I do need to point out that they said that they later contacted another attorney who disagreed. But this is highly unusual because it does expose people, to these types of liabilities. The other issue is that, if this were allowed, why wouldn't all for-profit businesses just set up a department that, did some charitable work and then take advantage of, tax-subsidized dollars and not having to pay tax on all of their revenue? Mm-hmm. You can see how this is not a tenable situation.
Stephanie Moulton, you've served on the Charitable Advisory Council to the Attorney General. Have you seen anything like this?
No, I think that this is absolutely the exception, not the norm for nonprofit organizations. One of the core principles of nonprofit organizations is something called the non-distribution constraint, which basically means that while nonprofit organizations generate profit, they do generate revenue. All of the revenue that they earn needs to go back into the charitable mission or purposes of the organization. And in general, most nonprofit organizations very much abide by this, and their board of directors oversees that indeed they are doing things in line with the charitable mission of the organization. So I would say this is definitely an exception. And also the idea of the intermediate sanctions or the excess benefit transaction that was mentioned. And I think so in this case, individuals can be personally liable if they do engage in this kind of behavior. And the reason the IRS did that was so that you wouldn't find good nonprofit organizations closing down over an individual that may have done something that caused excess benefit to themselves. So it can actually be the individual who becomes liable for that transaction rather than the entire nonprofit organization necessarily going down because of that transaction. So.
Lori Styron from CharityWatch.org, have you spoken to Greg Mortensen directly?
I have not spoken with him directly. As I mentioned before, I did speak with the operations director back mm-hmm. in 2009. Mr. Mortensen is a difficult person to get a hold of. 60 Minutes was not even able to get him to give them an interview or answer questions. So,
it's still early in all of this. Have you, either of you, feel free to jump in. What are the lessons to be learned from this Greg Mortensen case? Lori Styron, go ahead.
Sure. This really is an unusual situation, and fortunately, we don't see this type of thing going on all the time. So I would say, though, that this should be a lesson to donors to not let a charity's story or, some level of hero worship, which I think really did go on in this situation. People were very impressed by mm-hmm. Mr. Mortensen's books and by his very inspiring story. And donors didn't take that extra step to actually find out, well, he's saying that my money is going to support schools, and he has this great inspiring story about the needs of, children, especially girls in Afghanistan for, education, but is that really what my money is going for?
Stephanie Moulton, what have you taken away from this?
Yeah, I think the issue of good governance is very important here. One of the things that you'll find out as you look into this case is that they had a 3-member board of directors, one of the board members of which was Greg himself. So a sound management practice for nonprofit organizations would be to have about 5 board members minimum. That's not a rule. The IRS doesn't require that. However, that's typically a recommendation that you want a minimum of 5. And you want those board members to be relatively independent. They can be compensated. That's not necessarily illegal. But in this situation, you have the CEO and director of the organization who is definitely being compensated. Greg is the chair of the board as well. And so board oversight, it probably wasn't necessarily as independent as it could have been. And for many charities, many nonprofit organizations, they do have a functioning board of directors. The board may or may not have all of the skills and tools currently, and I think this situation might motivate boards to become more informed about fiscal practices within organizations, about good governance practices. There's a lot of free information available for board members of nonprofits. If you find yourself on a board or if you run a nonprofit organization, I think making sure that your board members are equipped with the information about what their duties are as board members. The Attorney General's office here in Ohio provides excellent resources for board members. And I think this, to me, this story provides a lesson of governance as much as anything else.
And listeners, give us a call. Your thoughts on charity oversight. We're going to take a quick break and then come back for a larger discussion on just how charities are rated, what regulatory framework exists, and what might need to be added to that framework. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, 292-8513, or send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.
Weekday mornings, prepare for the day with NPR's Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne, and hear local news updates from the award-winning WOSU News team. Listen to Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Get daily updates from the WOSU Newsroom by signing up for our Daily News Loop e-newsletter at wosu.org/email. You can also connect with our news team by following WOSU News on Twitter or liking our station on Facebook. 75 degrees under cloudy skies. Clouds throughout the day today with a slight chance of rain. The high will reach about 85 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 67. Mostly sunny for Thursday, a high of 87 degrees. Clear skies Thursday night, a low of 67. And looking ahead to Friday, sunshine and a high near 90. A few clouds Friday night, a low of 70. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann Fisher. And this morning, we're talking about charity oversight, improving transportation and transparency, and ethics in the nonprofit sector. Later, we'll be joined by the president and CEO of Charity Navigator. That's the country's largest charity evaluator. And we're still joined by Professor Stephanie Moulton, an assistant professor at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs. She's also served on the Charitable Advisory Council to the Ohio Attorney General. And still on the phone from Chicago is Lori Styron, the lead analyst at CharityWatch.org at the American Institute of Philanthropy. Lori Styron, we've talked quite a bit about your work that you've done in the Greg Mortensen case, but what exactly is Charity Watch? What does the organization do?
Sure. Well, we do charity ratings as well. We rate about 550 organizations. The reason we're not the largest group is because we're the most thorough. So what we do is we actually review a charity's audited financial statements. We also look at the charity's tax forms, and we do a very rigorous in-depth analysis of a charity's finances so that we can tell donors, okay, if you give $100 to this charity, how much of it is really going to be used on the programs that you are intending to support? How much is the charity really spending to raise money from you? And the reason that a rigorous analysis is needed is that a charity is allowed to include a lot of activities in its reported program spending that most donors would not consider to be the programs that they're looking to support. So there are many examples of this, but I'll give you one of the most egregious ones. If a charity spends, you know, say $3 million to send out direct mail to you that has trinkets and address labels and, you know, 10 requests for funds that you donate to them, as long as they include some sort of educational message like, don't forget to get your annual breast exam, or buckle your seatbelt, or don't do drugs, the charity is allowed to include millions of dollars of the costs that they paid to that fundraiser in their program spending. So when donors see little pie charts in charity marketing materials, or when they see what we refer to as robo-ratings of certain websites that just take a charity's reported spending at face value and kind of spit out some sort of rating, you know, that percentage you see a charity saying, oh, 90% is spent on programs or 85% is spent on programs, unless you really understand what is included in that percentage that they're giving you, it may or may not be representative of what you're intending to support. So we really dig into the finances and let donors know how charities are spending their dollars, and we rate charities on an A-plus through F scale. And lastly, you know, as as evidenced by our investigation into the Mortensen case for Central Asia Institute, we do a lot of investigative work as well, really digging into the activities of charities and reporting on them to donors.
I think a lot of people, when they hear the word charity, they get loosened up and maybe they get into the giving mood, pull out their checkbook. Is that common for charities to kind of, you say the Greg Mortensen case is kind of an extreme example, but is it common to skirt along the lines of legality?
Well, it's actually very, very easy to not do very much that's charitable and be for that to be perfectly legal. Under the First Amendment, there's no law requiring that a fundraiser pass along to the charity a certain percentage of your donation. And there's also no laws requiring that a charity spend a specific percentage of its budget on programs. So the difference between an outright fraud, where none of the money you donate to the charity is being used on programs, and a legitimate legal charity that may be spending 1% of your donation on programs, the difference between the outright fraud and the legitimate but highly inefficient charity is very small.
Sure. And we have Jim calling from Columbus with a comment about Greg Mortensen's book, Three Cups of Tea. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air.
Yeah, I did read his book, Three Cups of Tea, as well as that Stones of School on that. Yeah, I was impressed, and I kind of agree with what you mentioned. I wish he wouldn't have embellished the story a little bit, but I mean, guess the reality here, two things that really bother me is that, did he build schools? Did he buy textbooks? Did he employ teachers? And if so, how much of that did he really spend? And if you will read the books, you will also find that he admits, not an excuse, but he admits to being a rather bumbling type of person. That you know, the whole thing just kind of came up on my seat of the pants, like, oh yeah, I'll build a school in that city or that town that allegedly made him well. But he had no clue of how to do it. And so I guess I'm really confused about that that relating to him, and I think we're kind of assuming that he is maybe a crook or something. I think what's particularly egregious for him, and I have gotten his magazine, and he even sent an email back to me, and I said, would you please go back on to 60 Minutes? Will you please explain your particular position on this? I said, because I don't believe you are that person, you know? And, I mean, at least you certainly don't get that in reading his book, or I've been totally, you know, hoodwinked by him or so. And I guess sure. The other thing from a standpoint of the of what the lady's talking about is, since it was such a large organization, there's lots of money going on and everything, could they have been proactive on this instead of reactive? As far as whether he was legitimate or not.
Well, they said that there have, Jim, thanks for your call, that some lessons have been learned from the Greg Mortensen case. I'm reading here from the American Institute of Philanthropy's report. 60 Minutes sent investigators to the region to survey nearly 30 schools. It found that while some of the schools existed and were performing well, roughly half of them were empty, built by somebody else, or not receiving funding from the Central Asia Institute. That's Greg Mortensen's charity. One official said his school had not received any support from the charity for things like supplies or teacher salaries in years. Some schools are being sued by locals as used by locals as storage facilities for things like spinach or hay, and 6 schools in Afghanistan were found not to exist. So hopefully that answers some of Jim's questions about the school situation there. I have some more calls coming in. John from Riverside. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I was interested in what your guest had said, because it's true that, as I understand it, charities are usually nonprofit in the corporate business model, so they're nonprofit corporations. Nonprofit corporations take in revenue, they subtract expenses, and supposedly what's left over is called program money. I think she could correct me on that if I'm wrong. And usually what can happen in that case is, in bad times, the expenses can be increased and legally be increased so that salaries stay the same, but the actual program money decreases, so that eventually the people they're serving are getting less, but the people running the corporation actually don't suffer at all. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just a business model that probably should be looked at.
Stephanie Moulton or Lori Starr, neither of you give
them. Sure. That's not exactly right. It's a charity takes in contributions and raises other forms of revenue. Then they spend money on their programs and then also on overhead and fundraising. Whatever's left over, because the caller is correct, sometimes you spend less money in a particular year than you take in. Whatever's left over is saved for future years to be spent in future years. We don't downgrade a charity's rating if it has money left over, unless they're stockpiling large, very large quantities of it, of, you know, worth 3 years or more of their annual budget.
Stephanie Moulton, anything you could add?
No, I think that's right. And I think also, again, back to governance procedures as well. So not just looking at the financial efficiency of the organization, but also looking at how they oversee and manage those funds. If we take a snapshot at any given point in time, you might find an organization is saving up some revenue, for example. But what are the governance policies regarding how they save or invest that money? When are they planning to spend it on their public purpose? I think those are things that also provide insight.
We have a caller on the line. We have a caller on the line now who actually donated money to Greg Mortensen. Penny, go ahead.
Hi. I've never talked on the radio before.
That's okay.
Okay. Well, our school spent a lot of time raising money to send to Pennies for Peace, the program he did, and our school was covered in charts saying we had earned enough to like hire teachers for a year, and I think it's just horrible that he didn't use all the money. His mom even came to talk to our school once.
She came to our studio. She was on this show.
She was,
yeah, some time ago.
Oh, well, some of the stories were very sad, but I just heard on the radio that six of the schools he made up.
According to the CBS investigation.
Yeah, well, our school made a lot of money for it. I donated some money also, and it's just really sad about this.
Stephanie Moulton?
Yeah, I'd like to respond. I want to thank you for giving to the organization and for your school for engaging in philanthropy. And I really want you to know that this is important and what you're doing is important. And don't be discouraged by this situation. I mean, obviously, this is something that's disheartening. But there are many, many good charitable organizations out there doing very good things. And one of the saddest things, I think, from something like this is that we have people that lose faith in our charitable organizations and lose confidence, and perhaps rightly so. But I think we need to also remember that there are good charities out there and that we continue to support those charities that are doing good work. And I want to thank you and your school for what you did. And I believe they're, I don't know for sure if the money that was donated by schools, what that was used on. I believe that was separate from some of the other revenue that was generated. I read something about that on one of the programs. But I think that your work is good and what you're doing is good, and believing in philanthropy is a good thing. So,
well, Penny, thanks so much for your call. I have an email here from George in Columbus. George writes, do you have information on the Southern Poverty Law Center? I understand the Montgomery Advertiser did an expose on them, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. It found that it accumulated $200 million and then spent exorbitant amounts of money on executive salaries. Lori Starin or Stephanie Moulton, can you offer anything on that case?
Sure. That is a charity that we evaluate and rate, and I'm trying to look it up in our publication while I'm speaking with you. That is a charity that currently it could continue to operate for about 6.7 years at its current spending level without raising another penny. So we downgrade this charity's rating for that reason.
Well, why is that?
Well, because giving in the U.S. is a fixed pie. It would be great if there were enough charitable dollars to go around so that every charity could stockpile a lot of money for future needs that may or may not ever happen. But the fact is that charitable dollars are limited. Mm-hmm. And so we consider up to 3 years in reserve to be a reasonable reserve for charities to sort of weather, bad financial situations and sort of, if they have uneven spending depending on what their programs are. But we do believe that in excess of that is, it's typically not what donors are looking to support. When you give to a charity, they're usually not saying to you, oh, by the way, we might not use your money for, almost 7 years. I do want to point out, in their defense that if you just look at the efficiency with which they use their money, they spend about 60% of their spending on programs. That's not stellar on our rating scale. For that level would be about a B minus. We do downgrade them to an F though because of their high assets.
Sure. Listeners, give us a call. Do you have questions about charities, charity oversight, anything at all about the nonprofit sector? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email allsides@wosu.org. And we do have a call right now on the line from James. James, go ahead. You're on the air, sir.
I was curious about regulation of these televangelists who are nonprofits that advertise on TV all the time.
If I might jump in on that,
sure.
We actually published an article earlier this year on that is available on our website at charitywatch.org. What most people don't realize is that a lot of the televangelists belong to churches, and under IRS rules, because of the establishment clause of separation of church and state, a lot of these organizations are not required to publicly disclose how they're spending your money. I don't want to disparage any religion. If you're a religious person and you want to donate to a televangelist or to any type of church or other religious organization, that's definitely your prerogative. But you need to take the extra step then of holding those people accountable by saying, hey, I know you're not required to publicly disclose how you're using my money, to the broader public, but since I'm supporting you, please send me a copy of your audited financial statement.
Stephanie Moulton is someone who's consulted the Ohio Attorney General on charities. How do religious organizations differ from other nonprofits?
Sure. Religious organizations have an automatic exemption. So we talk about the 501c3 status of nonprofits, which basically means they don't have to pay taxes on income that they earn, but they also can receive any donors who make donations to those organizations can receive a charitable deduction on their taxes. For churches, religious organizations, they automatically get that 501c3 status, if you will. Donors are able to make donations to churches and can deduct that from their taxes, but churches are not required to file. The form that was being mentioned was the IRS 990 form. It's the tax form, if you will, of the nonprofit sector. They're not required to file that form. Now, many do. Many voluntarily file the form or do so because it's something that their stakeholders or supporters value, but they are not required to. So you can definitely ask them, though, and I think that was a great recommendation, to ask the charity that you're supporting to provide that information to you. And also there's resources. If you're here in Central Ohio, there's something called Power Philanthropy through the Columbus Foundation that provides information on nonprofit organizations, including financial statements and financial data that is beyond what you're going to find on an IRS Form 990.
And we have an email from Sarah who is asking how to get more information on charities. She says she personally gives to the American Cancer Society because it means something to her. So again, there's Power Philanthropy, charitywatch.org. And coming up in just a moment, we'll be joined by the president and CEO of Charity Navigator. That's coming up just after the break. Lori Styron from the American Institute of Philanthropy. She works on charity.org. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back. This is All Sides here on 89.7. NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we discuss House Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy and his influence on the Tea Party freshman with journalist Robert Draper. In Draper's recent New York Times Magazine article, he wrote, McCarthy recruited many of them and anointed them young guns. Draper has been covering the debt ceiling debate for his forthcoming book about the House. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. Hardwired to endure an environment of scarcity, the wolverine is one of the most efficient and resourceful carnivores on Earth. Watch Wolverine Chasing the Phantom tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. Cloudy skies today, a slight chance of rain, a high of 86 degrees, partly cloudy tonight, and a low of 67. Mostly sunny for Thursday, a high of 87 degrees, and clear skies Thursday night, a low of 67. Looking ahead to Friday, sunshine and a high near 90. It's easy to renew your 89.7 NPR News membership. Visit WOSU.org/renew to make your annual gift today. And while online, don't forget to have your membership renew automatically. It's a quick, easy, and efficient way to show your support. Visit WOSU.org/renew for more information. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
And welcome back to All Sides. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann Fisher. And this morning we're talking about rating charities and improving transparency and ethics in the nonprofit sector. Still with us in studio is Professor Stephanie Moulton, an assistant professor at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at Ohio State University. And all joining us now on the phone is Ken Berger. He's president and chief executive officer of Charity Navigator, the largest independent charity navigator. And before joining that organization, Ken worked in the charitable nonprofit sector for almost 30 years. Thanks for joining All Sides, Ken.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about Charity Navigator. We've been talking about rating charities a lot this morning, but what does your organization do specifically?
Well, we have a website that rates, at this stage, 5,500 charities, and our current rating system focuses on the finances of the organizations, and we do pull information from the 990s that were mentioned earlier in your show. And in addition to that, we are now adding, actually this summer, a second dimension, which is on accountability and transparency, which covers things that were also mentioned earlier. Questions such as how many independent board members do you have, and questions of the basic governance and ethics of the organization. So our mission is to be a guide to intelligent giving for donors of every kind, and so the search engine is the key tool on the website where people type in the name of a charity or a cause they're interested in, and they see the ratings of the charities on a scale from 0 to 4 stars based upon the performance of the charity. And there's all other kinds of tips and guides for donors on the website, a wealth of information. So our mission really is to serve donors so that they can make the best charitable giving decisions possible.
And your website is free, whereas some others charge a membership fee. How else is Charity Navigator different from, say, the American Institute of Philanthropy or their CharityWatch.org? What do you do differently or better?
Well, I think, you know, there are many ways to slice the views and analysis of the charities, and I think that one of the things that was real turning point for us is that we've always said to our users, looking at the finances of an organization, like many charity ratings do, and as we have historically done, is part of the puzzle of what you need to consider. But there are other things as well. And when we poll our users, we find that even though we say that, they rely very heavily, almost in some cases, almost entirely on Charity Navigator. And that's part of what has driven us to try to move toward what we're calling a three-dimensional rating system that encompasses the three critical things that donors need to consider. And many charity rating services don't do that. So in addition to finances, it's also important, I think as your Stephanie Moulton had mentioned, the governance issues, the ethical practices of the organization. And thirdly, most importantly of all, looking for data that shows the evidence of results, because a lot of charities will give you books like the Greg Mortensen situation. They'll tell you compelling stories, but when you really want to look for evidence of effectiveness of their performance, that's the third and most critical ingredient, and that's where we're moving in terms of converting our rating system. So it's I think that is unique, and, you know, we're moving toward getting to 10,000 charities. You know, there are 1.2 million charities in this country, but it's a little known fact that 10,000, actually the 5,000 we rate, get half of all of the private contributions that come into the sector. So there's a very small number of very large charities that get the lion's share of donors' money.
You say that some people rely entirely on Charity Navigator for their charitable giving, and we've also been talking about Greg Mortensen quite a bit this morning. Your organization had given his charity a very high rating. Did you drop the ball there?
Well, I would say that I would say no to that. I think that gets back to my earlier point, which is we believe that there are three different elements that you need to consider. And the reality is that finance is only one of them. And I think sometimes what can happen with some agencies is they do what I would call a sort of subjective, they don't have any fixed criteria, they make these judgment calls, and that's a very slippery slope. Mm-hmm. So if you want to maintain certain fixed standards of performance, then you can avoid those risks. But if the reporting is inaccurate, then you know, that's one of the vulnerabilities we all face, which is if there's falsification, a falsehood at play, that is another risk. That's another reason why we think it's so important to look at a charity from multiple angles, because the ability for a charity to engage in falsehood on every single level becomes increasingly difficult. So if you only look at the finances, you're only going to see one slice of the pie. You need to look at all these different elements. And so for in the case of Mortensen, one of the dimensions that we have now included is the question of how many independent board members do you have? And it's very telling that in a number of these cases, we saw it with a charity with Madonna recently as well, that indicator can be very, very powerful. So it's that need to look in multiple directions that is the challenge. And I think we're trying to continuously improve that. We implemented a donor advisory policy so that in cases where we think there is falsehood at play and the data, the self-reported data, is inaccurate, we then immediately post that. So that, in the case of Mortensen, they have a donor advisory because we don't trust the information that's available.
And yeah, that donor advisory reads, Charity Navigator has determined that the nature of these issues warrant making this information available so that no donors may determine for themselves whether such information is important in choosing to contribute to this charity. We do have some calls coming in. Kathy from Columbus. Good morning, Kathy. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering, is there any way to deal with the sharing of information among the different charities? Because the problem that I have is that it seems like I make a donation and then all of a sudden I'm on four or five different mailing lists and I'm to the point where I'm absolutely bombarded with all these solicitations. And I'm getting so frustrated that, you know, I just don't want to donate to anybody anymore. So I was wondering, is there any way to deal with that besides after the fact of getting on the mailing list and having to call and say, you know, I don't want to be on this mailing list. And it's just very time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And, you know, I'd rather deal with it proactively than, you know, after the fact.
Can you help her out, Ken?
Yeah, absolutely. And that gets to, we have a lot of tips on the website and we have a whole section on how to try to deal with those kind of challenges. One of the things that we look at is, does the charity have what's called a donor privacy policy, a promise that they will not sell your name, distribute your name to any other charities? There are other things you can do. You can have a no-call, no-mailing policy through the Direct Marketing Association, and we have a link to that website. There are limitations to it, though. Organizations have to voluntarily agree, so that may not solve your problem. There are other simple things you can do, like return to sender, and it's costing them money to send you that stuff, and if you keep writing return to sender on it, that can reduce it. We also recommend that you try to make a few larger donations to a smaller number of charities for a variety of reasons, and that can also help you avoid those lists. But really looking for the question, do they have a donor privacy policy, is a critical one. And we have that information on our site.
Stephanie Moulton?
Yeah, one thing I'd like to bring up here, there's a distinction to make when you're talking about solicitations over the phone between professional fundraisers and then fundraisers that are actually employed by the organization. And each state varies somewhat with how they regulate those fundraising activities. But one thing that many people don't know, when you get a call from a charity asking you to make a donation, you should be, they legally are obligated to tell you whether or not they are a professional fundraiser. That is, they are paid by an independent entity as a fundraiser, or are they employed by that organization? The reason that can be important, and this is related to the point, is that organizations that are professional fundraisers, they may keep 90% of the revenue for their independent organization, and only 10% actually goes back to the charity. So it's very important that you ask that question. And then the follow-up question would be to ask, are these organizations, or in Ohio, you actually, they're required to tell you what percentage of the money that they raise actually goes to the nonprofit organization. So there's not a cap in Ohio, but the Attorney General's office does require that if you ask, they have to tell you what percent of your dollar that you're giving actually goes to the organization.
Well, if I could just interject, we recommend that you never, ever give money over the telephone, because there are cases where those telemarketers have slick ways of, for example, being hired to become staff of the organization. There's all kinds of games that are played, and the safest course is to never give the money over the phone. If it's an organization you're interested in, then, you know, go to the website, take a look at the charity ratings and so forth, because there is such a tremendous amount of abuse going on with telemarketers online.
Absolutely, I'd agree.
Yeah. Kathy, I hope that answered your question. Jennifer calling with another resource. Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well, ma'am.
Stephanie is doing some great points. I work with the Ohio Association of Nonprofit Organizations, and there's been a lot of resources out there for the donor, but I did want to mention there were some resources out there for nonprofits. We are a resource for nonprofits all over the state of Ohio, but a major component of what we do is provide a lot of sample policies and procedures for nonprofits so they can start to implement some of these best practices. It's really important to us that we kind of bolster the public confidence in the nonprofit sector, and so we really encourage our organizations to kind of implement best practices, you know, on everything from board evaluations to internal controls to donor privacy policies. So we have a lot of samples and policies for nonprofits to be able to take some of these things and think about them in their organizations and start to implement some of these practices within their organizations. You know, are their board members related? Are they related to staff? You know, that becomes a real problem then when it comes time for salary reviews. So, you know, all those kinds of issues. So I just wanted to mention that that was a resource out there for the nonprofit side.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer. As someone who's not involved in the nonprofit sector, it's amazing how wide this network and this kind of spider web of nonprofits becomes. Is there any regulatory framework that does not exist that you think should? Stephanie Moulton.
You know, we have a kind of a three-pronged regulatory framework of the nonprofit sector. You have federal government, and that's IRS, primarily through the 990 form, the regulation of the tax-exempt status. And then you have the state governments, the Attorney General's office, and they're overseeing board governance issues as well as charitable solicitations and other allegations against nonprofits that may arise. And then third, you have this really robust self-regulatory framework, industry self-regulation, and that's where somebody like Charity Navigator comes in. You can also think of OANO, who was just on the phone, the Ohio Association of Nonprofit Organizations, the Better Business Bureau. All of those groups kind of form this robust industry self-regulating network, which I think is a very unique part of the nonprofit sector. So when you ask, are there any holes that we should close, one of the things that I think was good that did change was in 2008, the IRS Form 990 actually was significantly enhanced to include questions about governance and ethical practices and management. While the IRS is not currently regulating, for example, the number of board members or number of board meetings, they do require that these things are disclosed. So I think that was a step in the right direction. You know, I'm hesitant to say that we need a new regulatory framework, because I think the issue with the nonprofit sector is that it's so diverse and it's so heterogeneous. You've got hospitals in with animal shelters and with housing organizations. And to try to come up with one regulatory tool that's going to be the end-all, be-all fix for all organizations can be very difficult. So go ahead.
I think there is a real problem. And although I agree it's very robust, it's a little known fact that we're talking about one out of every 10 jobs in this country, and about 10% of GDP, it's trillions of dollars, is involved in the nonprofit sector. And the travesty that we see, it's not so much new regulations, it's enforcement of existing regulations. And with the implosion of state governments because of the economic crisis, and now the cutting back at the federal level, the people who are responsible for enforcing regulation and monitoring to assure that these abuses are caught and addressed quickly, it was very, very weak to begin with. And now we anticipate further cuts in the enforcement units at both the federal and the state level. And so we think there's a tremendous risk. And I would also add, having 30 years in the sector, although I agree that the majority of charities are not bad, there is a big, big problem. There are a lot of bad bad charities. I'm not saying a majority, but it is a big problem. There was something in the New York Times just on Monday about a scandal in that state, and we are getting calls all the time. Enforcement is critically important because, you know, as is evident from the conversation today, if you want to lie and cheat and abuse with all of the regulations supposedly there, there's a fair amount of wiggle room to do so, and we've got to have strong enforcement. And the problem is, at the federal level, the enforcement unit is within a tax agency, and so the mission to enforce laws on non-taxed organizations within an organization whose mission it is to bring in taxes, you can see some of the disconnect and the challenge where it sometimes may not get the priority that it should.
Stephanie Moulton, someone who's worked on the Charitable Advisory Council to the State Attorney General, how does Ohio compare to other states in terms of enforcement?
You know, that's a good question. The Attorney General's office is very involved in the nonprofit sector here in Ohio. I've been very impressed by their level of interest in the nonprofit sector and in their role with overseeing the activities of the nonprofit sector. I don't have any statistics or data to say, you know, how do we compare in terms of claims of abuse. I know charitable bingo was one of the main things that they ended up investigating. So unlike what you might think of, a lot of it's related to the activities around bingo. Trafficking in Ohio was actually one of the major issues.
That's a big problem, these bingo games.
Well, for the Attorney General's office, that was one of the complaints, was how is the revenue being raised? Is it being tracked appropriately? Because these are often smaller shops that are engaged in bingo, and are they registering appropriately and doing the right thing? In terms of the issues related to regulation, I would agree that it's about enforcement, not necessarily crafting a new policy. But I also think there's a distinction to make between mismanagement and fraud. So one of the things, for example, even on the IRS Form 990, a lot of organizations don't fill them out correctly. So even though they are reporting to the IRS, they don't know how to fill it out, or maybe they, you know, fraudulently are filling it out. But more likely, they just don't know how to fill the thing out correctly. So I think there's a lot of room for good, again, back to good management governance training for board members and staff of nonprofit organizations.
Ken, we're winding up the show here. Any other advice to people looking to give? Any things we haven't talked about that people need to know?
Well, the fundamental message, just to wrap it up, is that all the evidence shows that the vast majority of donors give from the heart, and it's a very loyalty, emotion-based connection. And we don't want to in any way discourage that. But a little bit of research, a little bit of using your head and looking at data can go a tremendous amount of way, of the distance, to get you to avoid the kind of problems that we're talking about. Occasionally, one may get past you, but more often than not, if you can just do a little bit of research, use the tools such as our organization has, you can really avoid a lot of problems.
Ken, on your website, you have a lot of lists, 10 charities routinely in the red, 10 supersized charities, 10 slam dunk charities. In just a few minutes, could you talk about all these, a lot of bad charities that are out there. Can you give us a couple that maybe people should not give to?
Well, as a broad category, the most frequent group of charities that get our lowest rating, zero rating, unfortunately happen to be those associated with police, firefighter, and veteran benevolent associations. And it gets back to something that I think Professor Moulton mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. A lot of these groups have a tendency to use telemarketers, and 95 cents on the dollar oftentimes is ending up in the pockets of these for-profit telemarketers. So be very, very careful, especially with those kind of – I mean, it's a very worthy cause, and there are some great ones.
Well,
but
sure.
Be careful. There's a lot of problems out there.
Don't forget, everyone, to give to your local public radio station. We all know how important that is.
Absolutely.
Ken Berger with Charity Navigator, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Pleasure.
And Stephanie Moulton, thank you so much again for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to All Sides here on 89 WOSU, 89.7 WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.